Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the 3 weeks ending the 13th of January 1924, the ethics of bombing Germany into the Stone Age. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. Parliament has convened but not opened. A speaker has been selected and members are being sworn in. However, it is unclear what sort of government, if any, will be formed. The Conservative/Unionist party is the largest, but doesn't have a majority and can't count on the support of the Liberals. Labour are in a similar position. There has been extensive flooding in Paris. Gustave Eiffel, architect of that rust and grime-covered monstrosity that bears his name, has died. Someone has attempted to assassinate Hirohito, Japan's regent. The government has resigned as a consequence. Someone also took pot shots at Mustafa Kemal, president of Turkey. In case you are wondering, Hirohito is regent because his father is, not to put too fine a point on this, not all there. A French airship has crashed in the Mediterranean. More seriously, a British submarine, L-24, was lost with all hands after it was rammed by the battleship Resolution during an exercise. There has been a correspondence about Victoria Station, or more accurately, the traffic situation in front of its entrance. It is not good. The Big Four railways have each unveiled proposals for new lines. The network peaked in 1912, or thereabouts, but that doesn't mean there aren't still a few opportunities for profit here and there. The reason they have all unveiled proposals at the same time is due to the opening of Parliament. All proposals need parliamentary approval. A rather peculiar announcement appeared on Saturday, the 29th of December. A number of existing airlines are to merge to form Imperial Airways, and the new airline is to receive a subsidy from the government. Why, you might ask? The Times does not say. I can only imagine the answer is something to do with the stipulation that all pilots have to be British and members of the Air Force Reserve, and that the planes have to be British-built. Someone is looking ahead to a future war and the need to have British pilots and a British aircraft industry. Even so, one imagines this is going to stifle competition in the air, as well as encourage other countries to do the same. This sort of thinking may have been what led to the curse of the flag carrier. During the last year or so, there has been the odd letter to the Times, none of which I have mentioned, decrying the presence of large billboard advertisements placed in fields in the countryside. They, the letters, have had their effect. On Monday the 31st of December, Pratt's, part of Standard Oil, announced they would be taking their signs down. BP was immediately shamed into following suit, which in turn led to Castrol being forced into placing an advert in the Times to remind people that they had never stooped so low. So much for the power of big oil. This is from Tuesday the 8th of January. At Bristol Police Court yesterday, Frederick George Knoll, 25, a Bristol man, was fined £5 with the alternative of 1 month's imprisonment for assaulting Mr. R.R. Crump, referee of the football match on Saturday last between Bristol Rovers and Boscombe. Reassuringly normal. Boscombe are nowadays known as Bournemouth. On Christmas Eve, The Times published its annual review of poverty. During the past year, poor law operations have been considerably influenced by the industrial condition of the country and by legislation dealing with unemployment. The statement of pauperism is a record of great human interest. It reveals a mass of poverty which only those who are in touch with it know very much about. The old system of relief through boards of guardians has proved inadequate to meet the needs of the people, so that the state has had to come to its aid with other measures and different methods of assistance. I can't deny I am rather taken aback to hear that comment about the boards of guardians. I have long thought that if the state, regardless of what the Times might think, the boards of guardians are very much part of the state, is to do poor relief, then it ought to do it locally. Local people have a better idea of what is needed, and, if they are paying the bills, have a greater incentive to keep costs down. On the other hand, this correspondent is a lot nearer the events in question, so should have a much better idea of what has been going on. On the other hand, yes, the third hand, you mean to say you don't have one? How often is it the case that people, as Ernest Benn might say, go looking for trouble, find it whether it exists or not, diagnose it incorrectly, and apply the wrong remedy? Modern welfare in the richest Britain that has ever been is vastly expensive. Heavier-than-air flight was only 20 years old, or so, in 1924, but technology has been moving on at a lightning pace. Air power had already proved its importance in the First World War. German air raids on civilians were largely ineffective, but with aircraft able to travel ever greater distances with ever greater payloads, attention is turning to how that might affect future wars. This is from Wednesday, the 2nd of January, and is from a Brigadier General Percy Groves. Admiral Sir Cyprian Bridge, a regular correspondent, contends in his letter, which appeared in the Times of December the 20th, that the sole method of gaining victory in air warfare will be to attack and destroy the enemy's air forces. He claims at the same time that attacks on centres of industry and population will be a reversion to the futile methods of early medieval naval wars. Is that true? I mean the bit about attacking enemy air forces. Not really. The Allies did gain air superiority in the Second World War, but that was mainly because they were able to outproduce the Germans. After the Battle of Britain, there was, as I understand it, very little fighter-to-fighter combat. He goes on. To my mind, these views discount the moral and material effects which would inevitably result from strategic bombardment on the scale which is now possible. They also disregard the obvious truth that a government can only wage war within the limits of resistance of its people, and therefore that victory may go to that side which is the first to break down the national morale of its opponent. He writes moral here, but means morale. Haig in his diaries also spelt it without the E. More to the point, he was wrong. The British did not crumble during the Blitz, and neither did the Germans when they reaped the whirlwind during the bomber campaign. There is no way of knowing what the atom bombs did to Japanese morale. What they did do was persuade the high command that they could not win. Even as I speak, the Russian campaign of missile strikes on Ukrainian civilians shows no signs of breaking their morale. Of course, Groves is writing in the shadow of the Great War, in which German civilian morale did collapse. But that was due to years of food shortages, followed by reverses at the front. He goes on. Consider the following supposititious case. We are at war with Germany, which has again become a great air power. She concentrates her aerial attacks upon such large and easy targets as the 700 square miles of London and the hundreds of square miles covered by the industrial centres of the Midlands and the North. As suppositions go, that's pretty good. We, on the other hand, confine ourselves to seeking out in a wide area her constantly moving aerodromes, her mobile echelons of supply and repair, and her carefully camouflaged aircraft factories. Our squadrons also endeavour to intercept the attackers, a very difficult task, particularly in bad weather conditions. As it happens, this is pretty much exactly what the Allies attempted to do, and succeeded in doing, during both Gulf Wars. During the Second World War, the RAF moved to area bombing, because cities were the only things they could hit with any accuracy. If the aerial strengths of the belligerents are equal, which side would be likely in such a contest first to gain the decisive advantages of breaking down the national morale of its opponent? London is the central nerve ganglion of our national life. Consider the effect of its destruction, or partial destruction, on the first phase of operations. I submit that the objectives for aerial attack and counterattack will be dictated, in the first place, by the vulnerability of the opposing peoples under the new provisions of strategic geography. Aircraft have rendered it impossible to attack the entire nation, that is, the people. In certain conditions, this method may offer the swiftest and most certain means to ensure victory. A great body of influential opinion in Great Britain has failed to grasp the actual scope and nature of air power. The aerial weapon is now supreme in the sphere of armaments. Correct. And its potential value in the sphere of policy is the reflex of its potential value in war. Yet we are still, to all intents and purposes, defenceless in the air. The science of aviation, which has already forged the paramount weapon, is still in its infancy. Its ally, chemical science, stands merely on the threshold of its possible application to explosives and poisons, which, oddly enough, won't get used. The whole apparatus of aerial warfare is changing constantly in a swift and stupendous progress towards perfection. Perfection did not have the absolute sense it does today. Meanwhile, the world is still governed by force. Vilna, the Ruhr, and Corfu are typical of the spirit which prevails in Europe. And Great Britain's navy cannot protect her against aerial attack. Failure to realise these facts and to take appropriate action must entail a bitter reckoning sooner or later. I would much rather listen to someone who makes bold predictions that turn out to be wrong than someone who hedges his bets. Groves is right about the importance of air warfare and quite wrong about the effect of bombing on civilian morale. Even so, right or wrong, the policy prescriptions might be very similar. Whether you are going to bomb civilians or the factories in which they work or the enemy's aerodromes, you're going to need long-range bombers. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.